The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the second night. There are four streams coming up. Sorry about the late start. There was a technical issue that had to be dealt with. And I'm now here with John Waters. John Waters has been on twice before. He's an Irish writer, journalist, and commentator, and he's now on Substack. John, thank you for agreeing to appear again, and would you like to introduce yourself for the audience?
Thanks, Colin. Yeah, I'm an ex-journalist, really. I mean, I suppose in a certain sense I am, but I'm not in the sense that journalism is now such a corrupted profession and kind of have to find a way. So I call them journaliers, and in that sense, I'm a journalist, but otherwise not. I'm a writer anyway, and I'm on Substack, johnwaters.substack.com, John Waters Unchained. I've written 10 books. I worked for many years for the Irish Times as a mainstream hack or columnist, whatever, you know. And about 10 years ago, coming up 10 years ago now, I just realized this thing had gone completely rotten and I didn't want anything more to do with it. And so I jacked out. And then suddenly, about three years ago, I discovered Substack. It had been going for a year or so and I got on it. I think I was the first in Ireland, actually, to get on it. And I've been on it ever since and it's going quite well, you know. So we're doing it. It's kind of like, you can feel it here in Ireland very strongly, Colin, there's an alternative media beginning to grow really quite exponentially now, you know, and it's really good. And there's lots of really talented people. Like, I remember years ago, I used to be an editor in alternative magazines back in the 80s in Dublin. And it was really hard to find good writers then, you know, but there's loads of them now. Lots and lots of writers and lots and lots of good bloggers and people doing videos and stuff. So, like, it's beginning to take off. You know, this has been, you know, sometimes we forget to look at closely at what we're doing and how much it's changing and how much is actually improving.
I think it would be interesting to talk about Substack briefly, because I think this is a key part of the revival. We talked about alt tech for a long time, but about 2017, I think, was the first time I heard that phrase. And there was an awareness then of the need for it, because even though the censorship of mainstream social media hadn't really begun in earnest yet, there were signs of it. Mm. And so people started talking about creating new platforms that would be insulated from it. And they even used the term free speech. Like, there'd be the free speech YouTube and the free speech Twitter and so on, which then became, it was seen by the left as a euphemism for far right YouTube, far right Twitter. You know, so Gab is the far right Twitter. Mm. And the thing is, in some ways, it was kind of true in the sense that people who had been banned for you know, I would say quite moderate right wing views ended up going to Gab and BitChute and so on. But for a while it was kind of shambolic, and then Substack emerged. I think about 2019, 2020. I didn't really discover it until 21, I guess, 22. And it's a different thing, isn't it? It feels much more professional than previous alt tech websites. I don't even think it brands itself as alt tech, which might be a strategic and wise decision in itself, because by using that term, you're marking yourself as an outsider, which perhaps isn't advisable.
Yeah, I don't think there are any actual demarcations. I do think that there are left wing people on there as well, and center people, you know, and it's quite an open platform in that sense. I think it's also open in the other sense, in that it's not like, you know, free speech Substack. It is just free speech. And that's really true. You, like, I've been on it now for over 2 years. I haven't had a single issue. with censorship or attempted censorship or anything like remotely like that, to just leave you to do what you're doing. That's been my experience. Maybe other people had other different experiences, but I don't think so. I don't hear about it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's crazy. I mean, the content I think is really good. Generally speaking, the stuff that you see coming through, I'm kind of signed up to lots of different other Substackers, and the content is really good, much higher than the mainstream media. I mean, I'm astonished when I read articles now by people that I knew writing in the mainstream, actually guys that I started off when I was an editor, who were really good writers and really good investigators and reporters. And they're just kind of knocking it out. Like, it's just the formula, you know, an intro paragraph, you know, a couple of quotes, get some expert in, take a couple of quotes from them, you know, a little bit of, you know, analysis, you know, whatever that is, and then put in the punchline and bish, bosh, bash, you're done. And it's so lazy and so cynical. That this is what they view their, this is how they view their readers. Whereas Substackers really, I think in general, certainly if not universally, seem to really want to do this really well and to do something really special, whatever their thing is, to make this really, like we used to do years ago in magazines, when I worked in magazines like in Hot Press or McGill or in Dublin. You know, we really wanted to write the best article that was going to be written that week, you know, and have something to be proud of, you know, when you see it in print. I mean, we used to, like when the magazines would come in and they'd be all in the binder and we'd open up the binding now and pull them out and everybody go leafing through it, like, and, you know, around the office, like, and just really thrilled with this. I can't imagine them doing that in the Irish Times much these days, you know.
No. No, I mean, you'd think that they would feel a sense of shame upon seeing their work in print.
Yeah, you would. I think they'd crawl away, you know, to the wages office, you know, and go home. It's a revolutionary concept as well, I think, you know, because we're so used to sort of the idea of, you know, a newsagent shop and the paper's there and you go in and you get them and same papers in each shop. And each person has, you know, they have a particular one, you know, Choice, Guardian, Telegraph, whatever. And this is now so kind of almost like, you know, chaotic. But yet it works. You know what I mean? There's so many Substackers. Like, sometimes you think there are more Substackers than there are readers. But, you know, it's just the way it seems. And everybody I get people signed on to me, like, and they tell you what else they're signed on to. And it says, you know, they list about three or four and then say, and 66 other Substacks, you know? And you think, oh, my God.
How much time do they have to read? Yeah. I know. I'll just mention that I started on Substack this year as well. And it's been great for me. I think the platform, the way a platform looks is actually very, very important psychologically, because it informs it. It puts you into a certain mood. It tells you what is the standard that is the norm here. Yeah. And Substack feels kind of elite. It feels classy. It feels smart.
Yeah, and it does.
And it also works well as well. That's the other thing. It just works. It's slick, you know.
Yeah. The one thing that I wonder about, Colin, and I literally don't know the answer to this, is because, you know, what happens is you send out your articles in the form of a newsletter to all your subscribers, right? And you know, whatever arrangement you want to have, they can be unpaid, paid, joint, half and half or whatever. But you send them all out, like, whatever number of hundreds or thousands. And that's the way most people seem to read it. But actually, it's also a website for each person, you know. So, and I don't know how many people are aware of this. I kind of think, because I look at my page, my Substack page, with all the last dozen or so articles there with their photographs and everything, and I've done all myself. And I feel very proud of it, you know. But I don't know how many people actually know it's there. Because that you can actually go in there and go right through back to the very beginning. The very first articles I wrote like 3.5 years ago are still there, you know, so you can look at it, like, there's at this stage over 400 different posts on there. And that's something that is, again, it's like two different kind of things happening in the same kind of move. You know, you have your website and you have your newsletter. And so I'd like to put out that there is something else there that you can go back and read everything. Even if you just signed up today, you can read 400 other articles or whatever it is. Not all articles, some interviews.
Absolutely. And it's also worth saying that your older articles won't be prominent on the website when someone goes to it. But you put just as much effort into those as you do into the new ones. So
yes.
It would be worth them digging through and seeing your old work. You know, with me, I think I put out, I think it was 30 essays this year. I can't remember now, but it was one a week throughout most of the year. And
yeah.
There were 3,000 words each. I mean, they were pretty extensive.
Yes.
And a lot of work. I mean, the start of this year, it was dominated from February to May. I was working like a Trojan on all these different essays. And then they sort of went out of the year.
Well, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but I'm very proud of it. It's
very interesting, Colin, because you see, I started off, as I said, in magazines, in like music magazines, like, which, you know, you could write an interview with 5,000-6,000 words, like, you know, and then other magazines like Miguel was a kind of a current affairs Irish thing, very unique, the Irish one, kind of like The Spectator, but different, you know, it had other elements like Mother Jones, kind of borrowed from American magazines. And that was way back in the 80s. And in Dublin, then the same kind of thing. And, you know, I started off writing long articles, you know, and that was, there was a high tolerance for long articles then, back in the 80s. But then I remember towards the end of the 80s, I remember actually noticing the decline in circulation of Miguel I was in. And we, myself and the CEO, or whatever he was at the time, went around the advertising agencies and kind of canvassed their views, what their research was telling them, you know. And by then, that was the first I heard of like a attention deficit, you know, that people were, their attention spans were shrinking, you know. And it's interesting, when I started Substack, I mean, I just took up where I left off, because one of the things I hated about the Irish Times was that over the years, they kept squeezing me into smaller and smaller corners, you know? So, you know, like when
it's
I was beginning...
It's to the bottom, though. I mean, you know, if back in the 80s, they hadn't, pandered to that trend, if no one had pandered to it, then the norm would remain lengthy articles.
Yes.
This would never have become a thing. And it wouldn't have, you know, the slippery slope thing wouldn't have come in, and it would still be the norm now.
Yes. And what I noticed, Colin, is that actually what I notice now is that people have stopped complaining. They were complaining in the beginning, you know, they're too long, your sentences are too long, your words are too long, your articles are too long, you know. I've been here a long time. I've been here a long time. I have a lot of long things to say. You know, but nobody is. No, I don't get complaints like that anymore, which is really interesting. You know, that basically people can get back into the habit, and I know that from my own experience. You know, like you'll know this, Colin, as well. Like in reading books, you can go through phases where you just can't get through a book, or you can't get. You've got five books on the go, and you at the same time, and you might just read about 50 pages on average out of each of them. You know, and then if you actually train yourself again to do that, you can actually get back into it for quite long periods.
Absolutely. It's a matter of mentality and habit and what you're accustomed to.
Yeah.
And so this is why I think it matters what the purveyors of things in our society, what they pander to, because that then creates, as I say, it alters people's behavior. And it's interesting. Sorry, you go.
Yeah, the process that I describe in the Irish Times from, say, 1990 through to 2014, which is the period I was in there. Like my articles went from having kind of a 2,500, my column, I meant, you know, you could actually get in 2,500 because it was on the top of the page, you know, and sort of you could push the line down, you could push, and the subs wouldn't spot it or they wouldn't do anything about it, you know. And but then they put me over on the side, and that was much narrower. Then there was two columns side by side, you know, and then they made it one column. So it started off 2,500, then it ended up 840 words at the end. And if you put in if you did 841, they would cut out the wrong word, the most important word.
You know, I what do you think about the role of editor? I mean, do you think, because to me, I would hate it if someone edited my work. But at the same time, you can understand why a writer who's, you know, it's easy to get a bit too fond of the sound of your own voice, and maybe you don't know when to just not use 1,000 words where 10 would do. And so maybe it's good to have an editor, but at the same time, you are sliding through someone's precious work.
There are good art editors and bad editors. I mean, they're kind of, and they're two departments, like in a book, say, and in a publication, like newspapers. Like, I remember once an editor saying to me, I was complaining about having him cutting my work, and he says, there's no article that cannot be cut by 400 words. I thought, well, what if it's only 401? Like, what are you going to do? That's the kind of brutalist kind of mentality that inhabits those circles in newspapers, because they just don't care. In fact, I would say that most editors hate particularly columnists, because they don't regard that. They usually come out of this, they're the sub, they're just come through the subs, or they come through the news division, and they kind of hate columnists, regard them as Ponzi kind of, swanning around the place, just airy fairy kind of thinking things, not looking into anything, not investigating anything. Whereas the fact is, if you're a successful columnist for a long time, you'd probably do a lot more digging than the average reporter does, but I do think in a book, and I do think if you had a really good editor in a magazine or in a newspaper, it could be highly productive, but it's very rare in that context. But you do meet people who are really brilliant editors in the book publishing industry. And they just have this capacity to read what you've written, understand it completely, even better than you do, maybe, and tell you where architecturally it needs attention.
That's the thing about a fresh perspective. They come into it and they quickly detect what is going on here, what is the main thrust here, and what is getting in the way of that main thrust?
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes it's amazing to see what somebody like that can come up with, but you need to have absolute faith in them. Like, I've had people that I just didn't trust and I wouldn't let them do anything. In fact, I had a really bad experience there with a book company called, this we called Continuum. They were bought up by some Bloomsbury. And I had a book, my last book with them, which didn't come out. They basically took my word, my manuscript, which was about, they said 90,000 was kind of the length of the book. I'd gone to about 105,000. And they basically, they I didn't hear from them. And the next thing, I got this document, which was just saying, it looked like my book, it felt like my book, but actually it wasn't. I couldn't recognize a lot of the sentences, because they'd basically got what they called a cutter to just savage the whole book to cut out 20,000 words out of it. And I just, I didn't know what it was about. And I just said, no, you're joking. This is a joke, April Fool. But, so you get all that stuff. The problem is, the publishing industry now has gone really, I don't know, it's not like it used to be. I know that it's very hard for people who are writing alternative non-mainstream analysis of things, like if you want to say a right conservative, that kind of thing, they're very careful about that kind of thing. And the whole, because a lot of the publishing industry is now completely woke internally, the staff of it.
Yeah, so
they actually point blank refuse to actually work on books they don't agree with. And the same actually happens, I found my last book, with bookshops, where the staff will kick up and say, we're not selling that book, and this happened with
this is frightening. I saw a video about a year ago now, made by Penguin on their YouTube channel. It showed their working process, what happens from the moment they receive a manuscript from the author, what is the process by which it eventually arrives on a shelf in a bookshop. And it was the graphic designers, the editors, the marketers, all of this. And it was all liberal women, right, from top to bottom of this process. It was Guardian readering women. And I thought, oh, my God, no wonder you hear all this stuff about the publishing industry, how they're just not going to take manuscripts from white men anymore. And well, they're pushing this and that. And look who's there.
Unless they're prepared to deliver the kind of book that the publishing industry wants, which is the book that is approved by the woke constituency. And there was an example of it recently, which I've been writing quite a bit about on my Substack. It's a book called Prophet Song, which won the Booker Prize, written by an Irish guy called Paul Lynch, who's a really good writer. I have to say that. He's a really good writer, as in terms of writing sentences. But the problem with this book is that it's about a dystopian, it's about a dystopia Ireland. You know, a coup has brought down this liberal government and tyranny reigns over the land, all this sort of stuff. And when I heard about this first, I said, wow, it's our Solzhenitsyn, you know, he's arrived already. Wow. But actually, then it turns out that it's all about, you know, populist, nationalist, far-right coup. So it's the direct opposite of what was actually happening while this guy was writing it.
Right.
And it seems that's kind of what you have to do now.
See, I think this is often the case, that they live in... I actually started writing a Substack essay about this, but I couldn't quite get to grips with it myself, so I've delayed it until next year. But it's this idea that writers on TV and in authors' literature today are living in a very much a fictitious world, and mentally, and that's the world from which they write. So for example, a guy who was involved with Doctor Who, Stephen Moffat, he was the showrunner for 5 years or so. He just did a drama a couple of years ago that had a scene in it where a white guy, they were on a train, busy, full of passengers, in broad daylight, middle of the day, and this white guy starts sexually harassing a pudgy black woman in full view of all the other passengers. And I thought, what are the odds of this ever happening? I mean, it must be like one in a million. It's just so preposterous. But in his world, where his mental world, the writer, this is completely plausible and probably happens quite often. So he's not misrepresenting. It's probably quite a common occurrence for this to happen in broad daylight in London today. And I think this is amazing. And so when you get this kind of thing with a far-right coup taking over the government or far-right mobs reducing people's freedom of speech or harassing and intimidating people, it's the complete inversion of the truth. But it does seem to be the mental world in which the writers
because in a sense, Colin, this is now the function of journalism, you know, it's the falsification of reality, and therefore if these people want to believe in, if they want to buy in, they can, and they can live in this pseudo reality that has constructed for them and accept all of its tenets and all of its kind of principles and all of its, you know, whatever the kind of street furniture of that pseudo reality is in any particular scene, and that means they can live normal lives, being writers, being artists, being poets, being musicians, being novelists, as if nothing had happened. It's only if they insist on telling the truth that there's a problem.
Yeah. It's like, if as long as you just go along with this lie, you're going to be fine and life's going to be easy.
Yes.
That's the
new normal, really. That's the promise of the new normal. Because remember, you know, the Klaus Schwab's line isn't just, you know, you'll own nothing. It's also, you'll be happy. But that's a contingent. You'll be happy if you do what we want you to do.
Yeah. Well, that's like the Soma thing in Brave New World, you know. People are happy.
Yeah.
And it's still sinister. It's still wrong.
Yeah, well, this is extraordinary. The thing that I find amazing about my former colleagues, they think they're still journalists, you know. They still think that they work for newspapers. But they're actually being paid by the government to falsify reality, and they're doing it and not noticing what they're doing. Because, you know, if you start with a falsified reality, you just embellish it each day. And you don't notice that you're actually telling lies anymore because you're just adding to what's there from yesterday.
Yeah, and you're getting further and further away from the possibility that this is all a lie because you're investing ever more into it. So it can't possibly be a big mistake because if so, then the mistake is getting bigger and bigger by the day.
And that's a very interesting study because when you go back 45 months, you know, they created this emergency and this deadly disease. And, you know, even those of us who eventually saw through it, or saw through it maybe straight away, it took it maybe in some cases weeks, in some cases days, in some cases hours. But there was a sense at that moment that there was something that needed addressing and that this was a way of dealing with it. And so you can see how the lie was phased in and then just added to and embellished and added to. And the falsification was barely noticeable. Once you were in there in the room, you know, it was just like, well, we're just developing this story. And if there was anything that was kind of incongruous within that. It was dealt with in some kind of, by some statement by a politician and explaining it. And this is amazing. What I find amazing about this is that the public seem to have learned how to read this without being alarmed. In other words, they fall in with it, no matter how absurd it may seem. Like we've had situations here in Ireland where, you know, some kind of official body, for some reason that is kind of incomprehensible, but they will correct mortality figures in relation to, say, the COVID thing. And there will be a new revised figure for death, say. This happened back in July of 2020. And then, you know, think, oh, they've cut it in half. So therefore that must change everything, mustn't it? But no, the next day they start giving out the old figure again, as if this correction had never happened, and nobody notices.
God almighty. I mean, it's like, again, it's like something from 1984.
Yeah, it is.
It's frightening.
It is. Well, you see, 1984 is an amazing, I was thinking about this recently, Colin, you know, that book, you know, the title, 1984, I just wonder, like, I kind of think it's a pity that if Orwell had, instead of saying 1984, if he had, say, 2054, would any of this stuff have happened? I think there's a certain sense in which once that date actually came and passed in reality, there was almost like a sense that, well, now it can't happen. Orwell was wrong.
A sense of relief that the urgency is over, disaster averted, we can relax.
That's right. And that societies became inoculated against, you know, they didn't any longer take precautions because they were so complacent about the fact, Orwell was wrong, you know. So, but it's strange that 1984, isn't it very interesting about that date? That when you think back to things that happened in the actual 1984, you never actually think about Orwell.
No.
1984 is a different thing. The year,
it's a different world, yeah.
It's a different thing. Like I came to Dublin in 1984 and I started work in Hot Press. I never think about that in terms of the Orwellian 1984, you know. So it's a very weird thing. There's something about this that sometimes you kind of wonder if these kind of dystopian stories are implanted in some sense or encouraged in some sense in order to create this sense of complacency that, oh, that could never happen.
That could be true. I mean, it would depend how advanced the system of control and censorship was in 1950 when the book was published. Did they want to do this then, or did it slip through? Did it happen because they couldn't stop it, or did it happen because they wanted this warning so that people would think they were on edge, that they were on alert, and then you can just trick them? Very weird stuff.
I have the same story about, I have the same kind of question about Paul Lynch's book. Now, it's a completely hypothetical question, and I don't know the answer to it. It's just a speculation. Like, is it possible that somebody in some office has a job where their job is to commission books which will fit within the pseudo-reality narrative and which will, in time, kind of fill out the history, not just the history, but the culture of the time, so that when people look back, this is what they will see, books about far-right coups, etc., and not the idea that liberal governments were ordering their police forces to drag people from cafes and buses and locking them up in concentration camps because they had a cold in their head or something like this, and that they paid for this service out of their own pockets as well. You know, will any of this...
That's definitely happening now, where they're fabricating a false record of this era so that when people look back on it, they'll think, oh, so the far right was just poised to take over society in the early 2020s. Thank God, just by the skin of their teeth, civilized democracy got through it and beat the fascists down. And so forth.
And this is, again, it's really astonishing because the guy who's doing the most pushing on this in Ireland is the commissioner of An Garda Síochána, the police force. An Garda Síochána means, in Irish, it means guardians of the peace, which is a great laugh. But he constantly talks about he's been talking for the last 4 years about the far right, but he can never define them. And he always says that they're so clever that they can't be found. He says, and then at one point he says, well, they have no leaders, but we're watching their leaders. They better know that we're watching them. And the United Nations, he says, they're nebulous. And they know where the line is, so they never cross it, which means that must mean they don't break the law. So it's none of your business what they're doing.
But, yeah.
But people don't seem to notice this. I mean, I really have conversations, not much, but occasionally I have conversations with what I used to think were intelligent people that I meet kind of from sort of Civvy Street, you know, and yeah, you're talking away to them and you're getting on well, you know, and you're not talking too much about the COVID thing or anything like that. And then I just, for the fun of it, I just sort of throw in something about how ridiculous it is, you know, these guys going on about the far right, and you know, it doesn't exist, you know. And then there'll be a long pause. Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, dear.
You know, like, this is, and this is somebody who you thought was smart.
But yeah, there are many stories like this where, and I got them, I read them from various people who would say, there's this guy I know, he's got a PhD, this woman I know, she's got 3 degrees and very thoughtful, very intelligent, but they completely fall for it. Yeah. They're completely enmeshed in this whole thing, this fiction.
Yeah, well, enmesh is the thing, you see, because all of the, there's so many ingredients of this which prop each other up, you know, they kind of, they need them. Like people who have, for example, maybe taken the vaccine and maybe are slightly worried at the back of their mind, they don't want to hear about it, they don't want to talk about it, you know. And so they have a vested interest in kind of, if they hear somebody saying, it's, oh, well, that's a far-right conspiracy theory, that gets rid of it, that puts it to bed, and they can sleep, they can go to bed then and sleep, you know. And I can understand that in a way, you know, because we all go into denial over things that we find awkward or, you know, unpleasant memories or whatever it would be, you know. It's like, you know, you kind of, you know, when I used to drink, like, you know, you'd have a terrible, you'd be on a terrible binge, you'd have a terrible hangover, and you would remember recurringly episodes from the previous night, like, oh my god, you know, and you just want to like squeeze it out of your consciousness. And I think there's, you know, this is a much darker, blacker thing, but it does seem to work something like that. And the pseudo reality serves that, it supplies all the necessary material.
It's constantly giving more evidence for it, like reinforcing this. I mean, you see it all the time in the news that they're constantly reinforcing the idea of, well, the far right, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, racism. It's like you would think that the streets were just full of, you know, white people just about to explode with racist rage and a killing spree. And it's simply not the case, but they continually drop this in and say it casually as if it's obviously the truth, and we all know this, we all know it's the truth, so that's there's right. No need even to make the case, just say it.
That's right. And you know, these kind of stories, like, they really they see, I have this thing about that the media, I've been trying to come up with a concept or a term that will describe the media, well, because it seems wrong to call them the media in any sense. I mean, the mainstream or the MSM or the legacy media, what's that like? What kind of legacy have they got? You know, I don't understand those concepts anymore. So I come up with this thing, which I call them the set-aside media. And the concept comes from 30 years ago when the European Union came up with this policy of set-aside for farmland. And the idea was that you could get an extra, the farmers could get grants for not using their land. But in order to actually qualify for that, they had to poison their fields, that they spray them with chemicals so that the satellite would be able to see that they were not using them, right? And I think of media now as like that, you know, that they've set aside the truth. They're no longer interested in facts, so they've sprayed those, they've poisoned all the truth and the facts. And as a result, therefore, you know, they're quite happy to do that. They're still making money. And somehow the existence, they create the far right. And then they imagine the far right into being, you know, like liars can do that. I've met in another context, lots of people who have that talent. They can lie and lie and lie and then start to believe the lies, so that when you give them the evidence that they're wrong, they're absolutely shell-shocked. And I think it's the same thing with these journal liars. Like, they actually believe in the mythologies they've created. And that then that exists, that specter outside their window, the far right, it gives them the capacity to believe even further and to be more impassioned and more galvanized in their determination that they're not. Yeah. So it's like a group think psychology, you know, that they create that outgroup. They start fictitious and then it becomes real for them. And then they become galvanized in their determination to stand up to this evil specter and make sure it doesn't take over the world.
Yeah, and I think the social pressure thing is a huge part of it, because what journalists, especially just starting out, they've got no standing of their own, wants to go against all of their colleagues at the magazine. Or I mean, it would be career suicide, possibly social suicide to do that.
Yeah, I know.
Imagine the pressure.
I know quite a good, well, not a good few, a few young lads in that situation, you know, and I kind of, you know, the last thing they wanted is association with me, you know, and I can understand that, because they wouldn't get anywhere. And this is their one chance in what they want to do with their lives. It's just bad timing from an ethical or from a whatever moral point of view. But that's what it is, and they have to therefore do what their elders, the elder lemons, are telling them to do, or else they won't get anywhere.
And so they have the grim discovery that what they thought was going to be a career in a machine that analyzes and finds and reports the truth is actually going to be a career in a machine that just disseminates lies and infection.
A lie factory, yeah. They work in a lie factory, and there's nothing they can do about it except deny it.
Yeah, or have some other career, some completely different career that doesn't even resemble the career they wanted to have.
Well, that would be the ideal thing, you know. That's certainly what I hope I would do. I think I would do, you know. But it's amazing when I think back of the journalism that I was lucky enough to get into in the 80s, which is really idealistic and passionate and, you know, motivated and advocate, you know, you were constantly trying to outdo the competition by doing better stories and you know, write them better and so on. That's all gone now, because you can see that the demoralization of the profession shows up in the way they write the articles now, because they're just awful. Like, they're just thrown out there.
Do you think that the emergence of the internet has got something to do with this, that there's just not so much money in, you know, working in the magazines and newspapers anymore?
Oh yeah, right. I mean, I found that very much in the last few years, you know. I mean, when I was like you get pretty much the same rate for journalism now as I was paying journalists in the mid 80s, and that's kind of, people are glad to get it, you know, 50 quid per 1,000 words. Like, they're kind of glad to get that. And it's amazing, the publications, I won't mention any names, amazing the publications that are high profile, really long running magazines that are paying that kind of money to journalists now. And I don't know how they survive on it. I really don't. I mean, I suggest get on Substack, you know, do it on Substack, because, you know, you can, you know, it's not that you're going to get rich on it unless you're living in America and you've worked for the New York Times for a few years. But you can get by. At a high, you know, at a level of, well, at least you've got a good conscience about it, and you know, you've got building your following, and you know, I think eventually that message has got to get through to journalists. Anybody in media who has anything to offer the world should get on Substack and build it up.
Yeah, the ship is sinking and it's going rotten, and it's just a horrible environment and a horrible enterprise to be part of. If you've got a soul, if you've got any honor and any fealty to the truth, then it's not the vehicle to be in anymore. No. But I think that brings us fairly elegantly to the matter that I thought we were going to focus on, because it's a natural thing, and I think people will definitely want to hear your views on this, which is Ireland this year, and especially the recent events in Dublin. what you were, you've been on twice before, you've talked about this broadly, but what would you say about the events over the last 2 years? And as I say, especially leading up to the Dublin riots?
Well, okay, there's lots of ways you could come at it, Colin. But I, the first thing I think, one way of starting off would be to say something like that the Irish people have essentially been dumped by their political class. It's quite clear now that Ireland is no longer run for the benefit of the people who consider themselves Irish, who are the indigenous population of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and who regard Ireland to varying degrees as, you know, worthy of affection and loyalty and love. Those people are not the fodder of the political system now. It's quite clear that something else is in train. There's a concept of replacement, which is, you know, Manu Camus, a Frenchman, has written a book about it. It's supposed to be a conspiracy theory, but actually it's a phrase that occurs in UN documents all over the place. It has the rationalization for it is that the population of the West is declining and the demographic crisis that is escalating. There's truth in that, of course, but you have to ask, well, how did that come about? Was that organic? Was it culturally orchestrated? I think there's a lot of evidence that it was. But the reality is now that you know, like, it's quite mind-boggling to see, because, you know, anybody who has grown up in Ireland, or indeed in any country where this is happening, and being accustomed to, like, politics, like the politicians wanted the votes of their people. Now they don't. They don't seem to care whether anybody even likes them anymore, because they have these extraordinarily contemptuous faces and ridiculous answers. And it's like, you know, two fingers every time.
Yeah.
But for the last 30 years, there's been, at first, a relatively slow trickle of mass migration into Ireland. It attracted a lot of attention in the early days. And it's actually interesting. I went back in recent times and we looked at old stories, old reports. And it's very interesting that in the early days, I'm talking about maybe the early years of the minute, it started in the mid-90s, but nobody really noticed very much until early noughties. And by then, there was a lot of stories in the newspapers about scammers. And that word was used quite well, you know, commonly. And like the EU police force, I think it used to be called Interpol, it's called something else now. But they were saying that, look, Ireland is a soft touch. Ireland is like a target for people traffickers. They were saying this quite openly at the time. But sometime between then and now, and it's, you know, it need to go through the newspapers of day by day for years to kind of figure out, to plot it, how it happened. But that has gone from a situation where basically that kind of reporting was happening as a matter of course. Now, there was a limit to what you could say by way of commentary. You know, there was kind of this concept of racism was floating around. But nothing like it is now. Certainly for the last 10 years, there has been like a total, you know, shutdown of commentary in the mainstream about this as a problem. You're not allowed to mention it as a problem. You're only mentioning it as an enrichment of Irish life and diversity and all these kind of things. And now it's escalated to the point where it's quite staggering. Because we used to say things like, you know, by 2050, Irish people could be, and we'd say could be, you know, a minority in their own country. Or, you know, the population of Ireland, the non-Irish population is something like 20%. Well, the latest CSO, Central Statistics Office, figures show that in the last census, which was taken year before last, I think, last year actually, show that Dublin, 35% of the population of the Dublin area is now non-national. One in three, more than one in three.
That's incredible.
It is incredible.
And, you know, everyone should be very alarmed by that. And it's amazing that they're not alarmed by it.
Well, you see, again, we're talking about the pseudo-reality, because the pseudo-reality contains elements of pseudo-moralism, whereby it is a good thing to welcome all comers. You see, it's a strange thing, you know about all this stuff like that. By having a different color face, somebody is entitled to a different moral stature in a society like Ireland's. You know what I mean? Like a white person is a low, now a person with a peel. I don't agree with the idea of concept of Irish people being white, but this is a word that's bandied around. I say pasty-faced people like me. We are a low, have a low level of entitlement now in Irish society. Whereas, you know, if you're a colored person or a black person, you're entitled to claim all kinds of exalted entitlements, like in, for example, the hate speech legislation, which the government drafted, and they're hoping to get it in soon. Let's hope they don't. They have what they call protected characteristics, which are profoundly racist ideas. Of course, the idea that somebody can, because of the color of their face, acquire special treatment under the law is itself a definition of racism.
Yeah, you know? In both directions, but. One thing that I think someone said this on Millennial last night, someone said that if there are protected classes, then that means there are unprotected classes. Well, isn't that really bad?
Well, I mean, I'm in an unusual situation here. I don't claim any great prophetic insights, but because of the way my life was going back about 20-odd years ago, I started off writing about the family courts. And I how unjust they were to fathers, single fathers in particular, but also to separated fathers. And I went into other areas like male suicide and, you know, male female relations and feminism and all that. And I got a lot of flack about that, you know. But it's strange now that I can see that, you know, a lot of what I was saying was highly prophetic. For example, I remember one time doing a kind of a funny kind of breakdown of the different kind of moral categories that were emerging in this new ideology that we had. Like, so I kind of said, well, you know, highest points in this new, I didn't even, the term culture and Marxism wasn't even, I don't think, well, certainly wasn't being bandied around. Nobody was using it. But in this, or woke or anything like this, there was no name for this. But I've said, remember an article I wrote, which is quite daring for its time, which is kind of probably around the turn of the millennium, was that, you know, a one-legged black lesbian would have probably close to the highest possible number of points, whereas a white straight male Christian would have minus points, right?
See, it's interesting that you would say that then, because the mythology is, or the historiography is, that at that time, Ireland was still a heavily pious Christian Catholic and completely homogenous country.
Ah, this is really interesting because, you see, this because of my peculiar journey, I started off stumbling on the issue of fathers in this context before I became a father. And I wrote a play exactly 30 years ago, went on in spring of 1994 at an arts festival in Kilkenny. And it was called Long Black Coat. And it was about this issue because I kept stumbling into guys who were having huge problems, either as single fathers or as separated fathers. And so that play actually, in a strange way, became prophetic of my own life, because I found myself 2 years later in the same situation, except with a daughter as opposed to a son. And in the play, it was a boy. And this is amazing. And this attracted, for reasons that you're aware of, Colin, a lot of publicity in the tabloids particularly, but not just the tabloids. And I remember, you know, being amazed, like, because they were really after me for everything, you know. But none of them ever found my play, even though it was in print. The book was in the bookshops, you know. And they could have got this and written articles about this and all the things I was saying in the play, but nobody ever saw it. Maybe they
sometimes,
didn't want
to. Sometimes it's funny, the things that they miss.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I gradually start to write out about it in journalistic form, about the family law courts. And, you know, in a strange way, that all of what I saw there, both what I from hearing stories, and this went on like for 20 years, like where in the end I was writing about families coming from fleeing from England to Ireland because they thought the Irish constitution would protect them because the social services over there were trying to seize their children on some spurious ground and have them basically forcibly adopted. And this was a commonplace thing. Brian Gerrish was fighting this really actively at the time as well. He's a UK column now. Like I was dealing with these people all the time and it was really horrific stuff. But the strange thing is that I saw a side of the state then that wasn't visible in any other area, but which is now visible, is what I mean in a sense when I say that the Irish people have been dumped. You know, that the same visage, the same demeanour greets the general public now as citizens of Ireland, as Irish people, as met the father in court in those years, in my experience. So in a certain sense, I had a baptism of fire and I had a kind of a dress rehearsal for everything that's happened in the last 45 months. I sometimes wonder, actually, literally, was it that? Was that one of the ground of the areas where they tried out some of these concepts, so to see how far would people be prepared to go? How much abuse could human beings take?
It's interesting you say that because, well, first of all, we've also said the same thing about COVID. Was that a sort of trial? And specifically New Zealand and Australia, where they're trial areas, where they would try something out, a method, whatever, and deploy it more broadly if it worked out. But also, this year I started work on a major project for my Substack, just plugging that there, and it will go out next year. And it's about the loony left in the 80s, which was radical leftist politics in Britain in the 80s. It's called the loony left. And one thought that occurred to me there was how similar a lot of their ideas were, and this is 40 years ago, to what is now called wokery today. And so it made me think, is that what was going on there, that they were trialing it in small areas first, where they thought it would be, the populace would be most amenable to it, before, yes, you know, going nationwide with it, as it were. But there was a 40-year delay, I think, because they realised it's just not time yet. They're not going to take it yet.
Yeah, it seemed to me that there was, I mean, the whole thing was so gratuitous, and the rationalisations for the things that happened were so flimsy. You know, that, oh, a child needs his mother, you know, until he's seven. Well, the problem is, if you do that, if you keep the father away until the child is seven, and I know very tragic cases where this actually was all too true, then that relationship will never work. And that child will be lost by virtue of the loss of his father or her father. But there was no talking to these people. I wrote dozens, if not hundreds, of articles about all this stuff. I was just laughed at. And what really infuriated me of all about this whole woke thing was when then the politicians decided they were going to introduce gay marriage and have gay families, they still didn't deal with the father issue. And they still haven't dealt with it. And it's like complete contempt. And that's the same contempt that we see now in the context of mass migration, where people in a town are told that, oh, yeah, we'll consult with you. But just because we consult doesn't mean we're going to listen to you. We're just going to tell you what we're going to do. Right. That's the consultation, you know. And you see all this sort of stuff, like whereby, you know, there was an ad in the paper the other day, somebody highlighted, where a Ukrainian couple, both of them employed, are looking for a house. Now, houses are very hard to find, or an apartment to rent. And they're saying, well, we're both working. And also we have 700 and whatever, 50 quid a week or a month from the government as an assistance in with our rent. That's something Irish people can't get. And what really gets me about this in both cases, like going back to the fathers, so that it would have been very easy to fix the issue with fathers. All you need to do is have a form of conciliation between parents and explain to them, look, your relationship doesn't work. It didn't work, fine. But you have another relationship, which is as parents, and that's very important, and the state takes an interest in that, and we're going to help you to get that right. But we're also going to insist that you make every effort, you know. And that would have worked, I think, in the vast majority of cases. But by the same token, like, you know, there's 14,000 people on the Irish people on the homeless list. Now, in one sense, that's a lot. Of course it is, for those people, each one. But compared to 100,000 plus Ukrainians, it's not such a lot. And the Irish government is able to give everything that those people need. Plus, there's a secondary layer of Ukrainians coming now, is the people who went to the made the mistake of going to France or somewhere first and realized that they only get a fraction of what they're going to get in Ireland. So they all want to come to Ireland. And they've been, for the last 6 months or so, they've been getting the same again. And still, the government close their faces to the Irish people and say, they don't even say it. They just don't do it.
It's one of those things. I mean, a lot of people might not have been very sympathetic to the homeless in the past, you know, of any political persuasion. But let's say people who now complain about this matter, they might not have had any sympathy for the homeless. They might have thought of them as, parasites, useless, did it to themselves, whatever. But that doesn't matter. You see, because once you then see Somalians or Nigerians or Congolese or whatever being treated better than the homeless, then you realize it gives you a different perspective and you think, okay, well, I might not have much admiration for the homeless, but surely they should be getting better treatment than these people who have no connection to this country at all.
But then you see the politicians, what they come up with is this, where's your humanity? Where's your humanity? Colin, where is your humanity?
Yeah.
And I say to them, I would say, okay, so you're being humane, you're being compassionate. Is that your story? Yeah, okay. So you're bringing in whatever, let's say you bring in 1 million Africans or whatever into Ireland, and you'll feel good about that, yeah? There's another 1.5 billion people in Africa. Are you going to bring them in as well? Or are you not compassionate for them?
Yeah. The argument I would use is, if you're being humane and compassionate to these foreigners, why don't you first be humane and compassionate towards your own homeless?
Of course, the people who are your people, whose people are paying for all this in the first instance. But you see, there's a trick here.
If you can afford this, then you could afford to deal with the much smaller number of native homeless.
Yes.
Clearly. So what are you doing?
But this is the thing. It is replacement, and it's replacement in multiple areas. It's replacement of the actual culture. It's replacement economically. It's replacement, in demographically and so on. It's also electoral replacement. They're basically replacing the electorate so that they will have dependent, grateful client base that they can assure. It's essentially a coup. Because they can ensure that they can.
Yeah, it's electorate replacement.
Yeah.
Finding a new electorate.
So this is what people need to understand. And it's frightening, Conor. I've explained this to people, and there's an aspect of it that is really quite, head shagging, shall we say, which is people say sometimes, well, this is our tax money. And our tax money is being misused in this way. And yeah, that's kind of true in a way, but it's not really true in this sense, that the money that's being used for this is not money that's coming out of the exchequer necessarily, or it's extra money that is made available for this supranationally. And it's also fake money. It's not real money. It's just, made on a screen. So that they can do this. See, there's unlimited resources for destruction at the moment. This is the astonishing thing about where we are, that for destructive purposes, there is no limit. But for actual constructive purposes, the same rules is always applied, because we don't have enough money to fix the potholes in your road. But we can give you 300.
Yeah, everything they don't want to do is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Very complicated. But everything they want to do, we can just work it out. We can do it.
But think about this, because people then say, you see, the trick that's being played on the people, you can see into it in a very clear and deeply unsettling way with the following. That then what you look at, you say, well, what's going to happen is these monies, of course, they will have to be repaid, because all money, eventually ends up in the upper pocket of Larry Fink. He has all the receipts and he's keeping them in there, And eventually, this will have to be repaid by the people living and working on the island of Ireland. The great-great-grandchildren, our great, okay, they'll say, well, that's our great-grandchildren or whatever. But it won't be your great-great-grandchildren, you see.
Yeah, so the Irish people get indebted, would that be the word, for being replaced. So they're paying for to be replaced. I mean, it's satanic.
It's satanic. That is, it's a word. Satanic has some of the qualities that allow you to feel it. I find the language is completely inadequate. Even the word satanic, you know, it doesn't do it. You know, there's leftover feelings in there after you say all of these words of rage and incomprehension,
perverse,
and grief more than anything. That this is being done to the Irish people by people they elected as their representatives to manage their country and cherish their country. And this is being done to them now in the name of compassion. Where's your humanity? You know, this gibberish that is coming out of their mouths, when all it is they're doing what they're told by their external overlords, and they're sorting out their mates on the ground who've done them favors in the past. You know, who have a little hotel somewhere that they can make a few million out of over the year, you know, all this sort of. So it's, and I mean, this unfortunately is part of the Irish story over the years, you know, that the internal, the quisling, you know, that was always present to sell his people and his country down the river. Well, it's happening again now. But you see, my problem is, Colin, I can only go so far. I mean, in describing, because this is so unprecedented. This is so, in our experience, I mean, of course it happened. This kind of thing happened under like the Cromwellian plantations and so on. But these smiling, smirking, shiny suited, you know, assholes, you know, their appearance and their platitudinous kind of utterances belie that comparison. Even though it's entirely valid. And the terrible, terrible thing is that because of the pseudo-reality, which even Cromwell wasn't able to construct, had no access to such technologies, most of the people who should be absolutely enraged, as enraged as I am, are going around the place, living in this pseudo-reality, and thinking about things that are irrelevant.
Oh, yeah. And to the extent that they have political awareness, a lot of them will be siding with their own enemies, siding with the people, the forces that are destroying them, and lambasting, demonizing those people who are trying to save them.
Yeah, there's a thing that I noticed, which is a kind of a time warped outlook on reality that you meet among people. You know, like you meet people and you know. Vaccinated, and you're trying to not mention the war, and you're just trying to keep the conversation general and all that, and you know, and then so you kind of a conversation begins to, nevertheless, it begins to stray into this area, not in specifics, but in the general sense, well, the state of the country type of thing, you know, and what you get then is just the most bizarre kind of gibberish. Talking about things that happened like 17 years ago or 32 years ago.
I had this exact experience with this woman years ago. And I mentioned Rotherham to her. This is a white woman, Scottish woman, who's some type of communist. And I mentioned Rotherham because she was saying, well, what's wrong with mass immigration and all this and that. So I said about this, Rotherham. And she didn't have anything to say about that. So she just switched the conversation over to the miner strikes in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like she was saying that this is who you're siding with, the people who shut down the mines and made people unemployed. What the hell are you talking about? That was 30 years ago then when I was having this conversation. What's going on right now? Get up to date. Get with the program.
That's why you're shaking your head saying, no, that's not what's wrong with the country. Like I remember actually there last year talking to a guy, a very intelligent guy. He's a doctor and all that down the country. And we're talking, I'm kind of gently leading him into this kind of, you know, the coup or using terminology like that. And he's looking at me like, what do you mean? Like, you know, and I said, well, you know, in this kind of way, these politicians are behaving and all this, kind of keeping it euphemistic to the extent, hoping that he's going to just, oh yeah. No. And he says, Oh, you mean Brexit?
Oh dear. You know, oh dear.
You know, no, I don't mean Brexit. And it's an astonishing thing that would you say this, you know, because I had a very, very interesting, that's one word for it, experience recently. Because I was away when all that stuff happened in Parnell Square in Dublin, the stabbings. And I mean, that's a whole story in itself, you know. I mean, that has yet to kind of emerge, and it's true, because there's something very strange about the whole thing. There's many strange aspects. I don't think we have time to go into it. But undoubtedly, that the behavior of the way that's been treated, the way it's been talked about, the way the media are dealing with it, is not normal for a story like that. You know, you would never get a situation where the victims would most of the victims would remain anonymous up to this yeah. point. And the journalists, the media would show no interest whatsoever in trying to talk to them or talk to somebody who knows them or something like that, for example. But that's another story. But the strange thing, I was away at that time, and I was coming back the next day, Friday, from flying in from Malaga. And taking off in Malaga, just before we took off, this woman came up to me in the I was in the outer seat in the aisle, and she started talking to me, but I couldn't hear because I'm deaf in this ear. And she said something about the country, and I said, "I'm sorry, I can't hear you," you know. And then she kind of seemed to be kind of, you know, pissed off, and she sort of just walked away. And I said, "Well, I don't know, whatever. Maybe she's just frustrated because I couldn't hear her, or whatever, you know." So I didn't think about it. But then when I arrived in Dublin and got into the, I just arrived up at the passport queue, she caught up with me again. And next thing, she started screaming at me, shouting that I was responsible for what happened in Dublin the night before. Was I happy now that I had caused the wreckage of Dublin and all this sort of stuff, you know? And I have to be honest now, I wasn't polite to her, you know, but that's beside the point. But at one point I said to her, I looked at her in the eye and said, "Do you realize that 3 children were stabbed yesterday in Dublin in the event that started this?" And for an instant, she just went, as if I told her something she didn't know. Literally for like 3-4 seconds, she kind of, you know, and it just struck me after. I was thinking about this, that she literally had forgotten the reason. Because you see, you think, it's again what we were talking about earlier, Colin, you know, that they give you an out. You know, they create the antidote in the riots. And they were created by the guard, by the police. Don't have no doubt about it. I've been watching this for years. I've seen these kind of escapades happen time and time again. And then that allows all the sympathetic people to their position to basically erase the first episode. So now it doesn't, you know, it's not that it doesn't matter, yeah. but this is the thing now to talk about.
And this very same thing happened around the very same time with Tommy Robinson and the Palestine stuff in London, when they were going to desecrate the memorial, the cenotaph, or there was a danger, there was a rumor, there was a risk that they could do that. And I don't think anyone would realistically be surprised if they had done that. That is the Palestinian protesters.
Yes.
But then Tommy Robinson and his crowd came in, and that enabled the media to just demonize any objection to the Palestine protest as racist and whatever. Even though Tommy Robinson isn't a racist or an anti-Semite by far. Yes. I think that was the whole purpose there. It was just to set it up so that, don't worry, you don't need to take this mass immigration problem seriously. You can instead hate the people who we're going to put in there.
Yeah,
but I think it was all deliberate.
But the thing that fascinates me about this whole syndrome, Colin, is the question. Like, we wouldn't have known before the Ides of March 2020, we wouldn't have known that this kind of thing was even possible. I don't think.
The level of coordination, I mean, it's astonishing. And yes. The sophistication and how easily an idea is spread. I don't think we've realized quite how advanced the machinery is, so to speak.
No, and also that there is an unprecedented nature thing here, like that is not, this has never happened before. I mean, people talk about Nuremberg too, for example, like in the context of consequences for the wrongdoers. They talk about Nuremberg too, and that's kind of died out now. And I can see why, because it's very simple in a way when you think about it, and it's very black. Because the reality is that 99%, and that's a pretty conservative estimate, of the establishments of the West are embroiled and implicated in these crimes. And they're now in cover-up mode. And they have all the power and control of all the instruments of dissemination of information and policing and judicial and so on and so forth. And this is a terrifying thing when you think about it, that actually we live in a world which is post-consequences for power, in a sense, unless something else. And then here I go again. I have a thing about the word unless, because no matter when I say something like this, I then always say unless. And then I think, well, what if there's no unless? And I don't want to be blackpilling everybody, but you know, you really do have to meditate on the possibility of where is the unless going to come from? If this is going to be different than it is has been for the last couple of years. Because like in World War II, you know, there were the Allies, you know, there were two sides. There's only one side in this one, in this particular module, the COVID lockdown module. There are different sides in the Ukraine war one and to the same extent, I suppose, in the Middle East one. But that's not clear how, you know, that the greater crimes that were committed in the West were under the rubric of COVID. And it seems that there's actually no way of getting in under those, because what you're seeing now is they're rolling out the same thing again. Not necessarily that they think people are going to buy into it, but by virtue of the fact that they're doing it is a kind of a plea of innocence. You know, this is, we're still trying to save lives here. Well, what's the problem? You know, what?
Is this about climate change?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, sorry, I was distracted. I think Ed Dutton isn't going to be able to make it tonight. I'm not sure yet, but just a message there. Miscommunication between him and me. Apologies if it turns out that way. The climate change thing, as I was saying about this last night, I think that they keep bringing it back, regardless. I mean, sometimes it goes away, sometimes something else has to take precedence, but they keep bringing it back. And I think they've got big plans for the whole concept.
Well, you see that they can introduce into the pseudo reality any element that they want because they have control of the media 100%. 100%. Like, it's not 99% with the media. You know, I mean, the main, like, because once you break away, you're outside, you're no longer media, and you're no longer recognized, and the word goes out that you're not reliable, not safe, you know, like,
yeah.
Like Tucker Carlson is now, he's far right. You know, he's
very much outside the social club, as it were.
Yeah, and it's incredible. Like the climate change thing is, you see, all of these things are inaccessible in our culture unless you have an honest media. You know, the way media used to work. You know, journalists are not experts, generally speaking, in any particular thing, but they have an expertise in mediation of information. So, you know, if you're a scientist and a climate scientist, and you know, you're talking in, you know, convoluted kind of concepts, and I go to interview you, I say, okay, well, tell me what's your position, and I kind of maybe 25% understand it. So I spend an hour trying to bring that up to 90 or 95% understanding so that I can write an article that's comprehensible. And that was kind of the way that journalism worked, you know, that then people became informed and they were democratically aware and democratically activated on that question. But now, the way the experts talk down to them, and the experts are such that each expert only knows a tiny sliver. That's his expertise, right? That's it there, right? And then there's another expert beside him, and he has another sliver that doesn't quite touch, but it's right there, right? And then so on. And all the experts talk about their different disciplines, but none of them contradict each other because they don't have the expertise to do that. So yeah. That there's no overarching kind of wisdom as there would have been like a couple of hundred years ago, where you would have a philosopher who would know all this stuff at a certain level and be able to take it apart and parse it and educate the people so they would know then. And this is terrifying. We're locked into this model of science.
Of experts and sort of technocratic mentality, where it's all about numbers. We saw this very much, the rise of this during COVID, although you could have foreseen it with the climate change stuff 10 years before that. But this idea that it's all about what the scientific data tells us. And the person to tell us what it tells us is this expert. And don't look into his funding. That doesn't matter. Yeah.
And one of the things you find about that is that these guys are actually working with models. You know, like in the COVID thing, what we were dealing with most of the time was models, which were just hypotheses of things which eventually were shown to be crazily out.
And what was the guy? I always forget his name. The guy who came up with the model and he vastly overestimated how many
Ferguson. Again, you couldn't question that because, well, are you a virologist? No.
Okay. Exactly. Well, exactly. Yeah. What are your credentials?
So that means that, you know, things that have an absolutely detrimental effect on our lives and on that future and our children's future, we're not entitled to speak about them because we haven't done 4 years in Cambridge studying microbiology.
Yeah.
That's a complete affront to democracy.
But also to common sense, because it implies that you should just let experts tell you anything.
Yeah.
And you've just got to believe them. And I think that can never be the case. I mean, obviously, yeah, we should yield to experts now and then. But when their advice or their findings are egregious and obviously contrary to common sense or damaging to the public welfare or whatever, then common sense has to intervene. And
well,
that's never allowed to happen.
Well, you see, this is where we're into the really dark center of everything now, because we're basically in a world that would have been impossible to predict 30 years ago, that you would degenerate and regress to the extent that we have under so many headings and have lost at the same time democratic capability to deal with these things, so that more and more the power is drifting, you know, in it's gone upwards. It's almost like as if it's an egg timer, somebody's flipped it over and it's now all the power is at the top again. The democracy, democratic realm is now completely emptied of power, and the dust or whatever you call it, the grains are coming down in slow motion, and the balance will not be restored for maybe 50 years. Who knows? And this is, I saw a very interesting, well, it wasn't particularly interesting, but it was a good topic on the discussion between Brett Weinstein, he's an American biologist, and Dave Rubin, he's on YouTube, and it's on at the moment. It's just come on, and it's about an hour in length, and the first half hour is really interesting because they're raising this question about where we are and how we got here and how we didn't avoid getting here when it was kind of clear that so many things that were happening and being done were really off the wall.
Yeah, and I think people just didn't know what to be aware of. I mean, the international NGOs, that was pretty obviously had the potential to be sinister.
But it was clear from a long time that academia was in serious trouble, like that the kind of all kinds of bullshit had crept in there. And, you know, that kind of like leftist mentality had really spread like wildfire through the university system of all the Western countries. And but one of the things they were saying, I mean, they were talking about different things, but it was, one of the things I found interesting was that they were zeroing in on a point, because they were trying to find, well, at what point could you go back to when everything was relatively okay? And that if you were able to teleport back to that point now to warn those people of where they were going to end up if they weren't careful, what would they settled on 1995, which I actually think is about right as well. That, you know,
the 80s. I just said more like 1965 or 75.
Well, no, you see, I think I don't know. My memory of Ireland, certainly, in Ireland in the 70s and 80s was a really good place.
Yeah, yeah.
And it started to go. And now, economically, it wasn't. You know, and that, in a sense, you see, this is the paradox here, Colin, that when things get, we can now create a new rule that when things go well for Ireland economically, everything else goes to pot. And vice versa, you know, when everything is good, then the economy doesn't work, you know. And that seems to be some kind of iron law, certainly of the last 50 years anyway. So I would say that, you know, the rot started again, and it started to creep in the early 90s, I think, in Ireland. Like, we had this election for the first woman president, the first Mary Robinson, which everybody thought was a great idea, or a lot of people thought was a great idea at the time, but really she just turned out to be the most appalling globalist, you know, and now she's on all these climate change committees and the UN and all this sort of stuff, and she's like absolutely, you know, Freemasonic central, you know. But you know, it's that kind of thing that we're now in this situation where, like, we've slid backwards, not forward. Like, it's like the clock's gone, and we're now back in a situation where, if you could describe mid-80s Ireland to us now, we think that was Nirvana.
Oh, yeah. I saw a clip from The Commitments, which was 1990. It was a film, which was a big film at the time.
Yeah, Ronnie Doyle's book, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the younger viewers won't be familiar with it, but I remember the poster for it was iconic. You saw it all over the place, like the train spotting one 5 years later. And I saw a clip of it recently, and it shows some, you know, Irish village, and it's just like a different age, a different world completely from the Ireland of today. And I dare say it was a bit idealized even then. I think they would be showing a cutesy version of it, you know,
but not that far, you know, not that much, you know. I mean, Doyle was relatively faithful to his hinterland, you know. But you see, there are so many things about Ireland now that you kind of look back on in absolute mystification. Like the 80s were such a great, rich time for music in Ireland, you know, bands emerging, artists emerging every other day, you know, and I was in Hot Press at that time. And like, it was really astonishing, but now there's nothing. There's literally nothing. It's dead, and so the country is the richest country in the world, we're told, but nobody sees any evidence of this, like, other than reading it in the Irish Times, and of course the only people profiting from Ireland are outsiders, and in every sense of the world, and it's in a certain sense appropriate, therefore, that they're bringing in so many immigrants from outside to allow them to spend the money, you know, I suppose. But this is a trick that was played on the Irish people over many years, going back, you know, 50 years. In that sense, you're 100% right. You know, I mean, that, you know, you have to go back to the late 60s, the early 70s, when the campaign was afoot to have Ireland join the EU. And we joined at the same time as the United Kingdom. And, like, everything was disaster after that. I remember my father was completely opposed to that. Like, and I remember, like, that day, the 1st of January 1973, was like, he used to drive a mail van or a mail car, and we were driving around, like, and it was like he was driving a hearse that day. You know, he was so somber. That mood was entirely justified by what I see around me now. He's long dead, like, but, you know, I'm glad he is, like, because he wouldn't be the kind of man who would say, "I told you so." He'd be the man who would be just heartbroken that he was right, you know. And that's the way I feel. I mean, somebody wrote to me the other day. He says, you know, that's a very funny line. He said, "John," he says, I wish I lived in a world where you were never right about anything."
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I said, so do I. I wish I was going around saying things that were completely wrong all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's not actually fun to be right about this stuff.
No, it is not. No. I mean, it's there's no moment when we'll be able to look back in smugly and say, "I told you so." I mean, that's the last sentence we're ever going to utter, any of us.
Yeah. It's not pleasant. I wish that, you know, the West was not declining. I wish that Britain wasn't dying, and every other Western country. But they are going through, let's not say dying, but they are going through a terrible phase. I think that's fair to say. But look, we've only got a few minutes left. So I want to, there are some super chats. So I want to address those. Pox says, "Happy millennial. In our lifetimes, Ireland for the Irish has gone from a dream that was dreamed by Ireland's heroes to far-right hate speech. What are Mr. Waters' thoughts on how this has come to pass in the Irish psyche? Thanks, gents." I think we've basically gone into that, but would you like to give a summary?
There's another dimension which I've talked about a lot. I won't go into it, but it's the kind of Ireland's colonial past, if you like, a relationship with England in particular, you know, that kind of relationship does foster a certain kind of self-loathing. And that's been very visible in Ireland over the years. I mean, something I've written about an awful lot over the last 30, 40 years. And the people actually, Irish people, they have a kind of an almost like an alcoholic kind of personality, which is like egomania combined with self-inferiority complex. And you know, they're constantly kind of seeking to kind of big themselves up, and they love outsiders praising them, you know. So this is a kind of a virtue signaling that's going on, yeah, at an official level, at a cultural level.
And seeking approval from...
Yes.
Perceived betters.
Yes, aren't we great? And there's a certain residue also in it. It seems like a paradox, but of kind of post-Christian, it's like a residue of Christianity, a misunderstanding of Christianity, which, of course, isn't at all what the Christian teaching is, because Thomas Aquinas, if people look up Thomas Aquinas on mass migration, he takes a very commonsensical view of it, like, and doesn't approve of it at all in most instances. And where it does happen, and where people come into your country, they have a duty to be part of your culture. You do not have any responsibility to absorb them or to go out of your way, and so on. But there's this kind of crude notion of Christianity that you have to basically, you know, give everything away to outsiders. And that's been used now against the Irish people, because it's a kind of a blackmail weapon, you know. At some level in their hearts, people still believe that's true. You know, the idea of if you have two coats, you know, give one to one who has none. Well, yeah, but he didn't say give your coat to the government so he could give it to outsiders, you know. Like, you know, it's a different thing. And people need to kind of wise up and start thinking these things through. Because all these rationalizations and bully phrases, they're all lies, and they're all constructions designed to manipulate. And people are being manipulated into giving up their children's home place, homeland.
Yeah, absolutely. Kit says, let's be clear, mass immigration is a deliberate objective. It is pushed hard by the blob. Pointing out that it hurts native people is going to make as much difference as telling a burglar that burglary hurts people. It's the point. We deserve it. Yeah, I think there is an aspect of that. I don't think it's so much that we are hated. It's that this is simply the program in place, that for whatever reason, probably economic reasons, I think it's depopulation. I don't know.
That's true. But there's a sort of a flavor in that's kind of touching into the kind of the post-imperial history of the West, right? You know, that in that sense, we deserve it, you know. But Ireland didn't have that history, you know.
Yeah,
and of all the places in Europe that you might think of, Ireland is the least blameworthy in that context. But it makes no difference.
No, because another sin is substituted, which is that the Irish moved everywhere. They migrated. They were migrants. Yeah,
that's right. And it's like, you know, that this is the same thing as like hundreds of feet of young guys being dumped in a tiny village in the west of Ireland and allowed to hang around the street corners, or you know, leching after women all the time. And that this is the same as Irish people fleeing famine, you know, fighting debt, racing against debt on the way to America in order to build America with their bare hands. And that this is the same thing. It's not the same.
It's a grotesque comparison.
Yes.
Okay. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, do you have any faith in Conor McGregor tying himself to the grassroots protest in Ireland and his recent Twitter desire to become president of Ireland?
I don't know. It's too early to say yet, to be honest. I haven't really got the measure of him. I mean, he has a lot of good qualities, you know, I think. I mean, he's a very interesting figure in the context that he's presented himself in now. I don't know to what extent he's using that presidency thing as an instrument to try and get publicity for the cause, for the issue. I mean, I can't imagine anybody really wants to be president of Ireland now, you know, at this moment. I mean, it would be a hellish job. It already is a hellish job. It's a terrible, boring job. Opening community centres, like, who wants to do that, you know? Like it has no power, really. And any power it has, the president, the incumbent, never uses, which is the power, for example, not to allow apartheid into your country. Like, that would be one power that would have been useful, but it wasn't used. I think, you know, I think it's a positive thing that Connor is speaking. I think it, because there are so few people of note who are at that level, who are talking about this. I've noticed this over the years. They'll tell you secretly, they'll sidle up to you and say, oh, it's terrible, isn't it? Terrible, terrible. I say, why don't you say something publicly? And, no,
of course.
So Connor, you know, you got to give it to Connor that he's actually put his mouth where his money is, as it were. And, you know, fair play. I mean, but let's see. I don't know. I mean, you see, they'll come after him, you know, and who knows what effect that's going to have, because, you know, people have families, people, I mean, when you get involved in this kind of stuff, it is, as we say in Ireland, this is senior hurling, you know, this is, you know, this isn't, you know.
Yeah, there are limits to what people can withstand, kind of harassment they can put up with, for sure. Oliver says, the former Vatican chief has said mass immigration is not about helping people, but about destroying national identity. He says they want all Western people atomized to prevent nationalism and wars.
Yes.
Is this view gradually becoming mainstream? I think he means awareness of this becoming.
The German cardinal, what's this, his name was? Sorry, I should know this. I saw that there a couple of weeks ago. And there was another cardinal there, Cardinal Robert Sarah, who said very similar things there a couple of years ago, and he's actually an African himself. This is the paradox. This is the mainstream view. It's just that the pseudo realities that have been built in our societies is suppressing it and keeping it at bay. I heard a very interesting anecdote there recently about a particular place in Ireland where they were trying to dump. Still are trying to dump hundreds of these guys, and they've already taken quite a lot of people migrants in this particular area, and they were sort of, there was a lot of disgruntlement, but it was actually a post woman, postie they call them now, who actually figured out, because she was going to all the houses and she was meeting everybody. They would almost meet her at the door. They would open the door before she put the letters in and say, "Oh, what's going on? Do you see what's happening?" And she realized this has happened to her in every house virtually. But she said none of these people were talking to each other. There was no connectivity because of that. Because of the pseudo reality. It's so important. It's like literally trying to walk through mud to get to the other side of the road. And so she actually organized a public meeting, and she told everybody individually, this meeting is on. And she got like 1,800 people in the hall, the local hall, that for that meeting. And that's a kind of a parable of Ireland's condition, you know, that so many people, certainly in large tracts of it, not in certain pockets where, you know, South Dublin, where there's affluent societies who read the Irish Times and so on, and are just so indoctrinated up to their eyeballs that there's no hope for them. But the generality of the population are now wide awake. I found this the last year or so, whereas going back 3 years talking about COVID, people would run away from me, you know, down the country, farmers and all that, like, you know, because they kind of three quarters believed it. But now there's nothing I'm saying to them that they're kind of balking at.
I think that awareness of mass immigration is really spreading, and that it's a problem. It's a social problem. It's causing disruption. Let's just put it that way. I think that people are now aware of that who would have been vehemently against such a statement.
And they're becoming aware of the demeanor of the politicians as well, which is not organic. It's not natural at all in any way like this. So it's almost like there's a psychotic element to it that almost you'd feel is chemically induced or something, you know, that they're bypassed their capacities for empathy completely.
When Varadkar made that statement about the rioters, it was grotesque.
Yeah.
Your wives and daughters are afraid of you.
Yes.
I mean, it was just so dishonest and manipulative.
And that mirrored or mimicked the thing that they've been doing for the last couple of years, when there has been incidents where migrants have attacked and killed people in really awful incidents. And they immediately announced this campaign against Irish misogyny and Irish homophobia or whatever, you know, as if this was an Irish person that had done this, or, you know, when in fact they know full well that the people that are being suspected and who will eventually be charged were actually migrants to Ireland. But this is a kind of a psyop that they introduce immediately. And again, it invokes that amnesia in some strange way, that, you know, you can find that actually a year later and you say, you talk about something and the people say, what's that? You know, even though it was an appalling episode. No, I don't. I think I remember something about that. Yeah. That was some fella got attacked. Yeah. So this works. And it's an amazing thing that they arrived to this situation knowing that this would work. They're not experimenting. They're actually carrying out measures and mechanisms that they're executing mechanisms that actually they know will function in exactly the way that they do.
Yeah, it's a scary time. I'm going to have to end the stream now, and I'm sorry about the various technical problems that have come up. It's not been as relaxed as I would have liked, but nothing that can be done about it, I'm afraid. I am very glad. I hope this was enjoyable to people. Unfortunately, another technical problem that's come up is I can't access the Odyssey stream, so I can't see the comments and I can't see the super chats on there. For some reason, that's a glitch with Odyssey. This is what it is when you're broadcasting to multiple platforms. You've got to deal with the problems of each particular platform. So I'm sorry, the Odyssey hyper chats I can't get for this stream. Very annoying. My apologies. Nothing that can be done about it, I'm afraid. But I do think this has been a good conversation. So, John Waters, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you very much, Colin. Great pleasure.
Okay. I will be back imminently with Ed Dutton. So that stream is going to go ahead. So in the meantime, well, thank you for watching. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.